Open the door to huge savings now at Menards. Enhance the appearance of your home with a new stylish garage door. Choose from our large in-stock selection of ideal garage doors or design your own using our free garage door designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big and ideal garage doors. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello and welcome to a bumper edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks with me, Michelle Owen from Sky Sports.
Me, Sam Matterface from TalkSport and ITV.
And me, Alex Crook from TalkSport, a national newspaper journalist.
Coming up, the most famous name in written sports journalism, the chief football writer at the Times, Henry Winter.
It's a serious England international, serious goal scorer. And so what are you thinking about just before you walk out? You're thinking about the sort of the pride your family and your friends must feel. You're talking about how's it going to go against the individual centre-half you're up against. And he said, no, all I can think about is the ratings I'm going to get in the papers in the morning. Because if it's bad, if it's like a 4 out of 10, then his mother's going to have it mentioned when she goes into the... goes sort of out shopping or goes into work or whatever, and it affects all their families.
I've been sent to Coventry to find out what the local media are doing to prevent the 1987 FA Cup winners from becoming homeless and maybe even going extinct.
I'm talking about Wembley and how a row with two Manchester City fans over a kebab turned into a bit of a bromance.
Plus, the Week in Numbers tells us Liverpool are going to be absolutely gutted if they don't win the Premier League, because they should have already.
All on the podcast that is softer than a Carl Walker Glaswegian kiss, it's All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
It's all over, I think.
No. Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
I'm back.
Well, we missed you last week, and we know that you're not 100%, so we'll try and give you an easy workload if we can. Did you have a good week, Crook?
Yeah, I did actually. Coventry was interesting. We're going to be talking about that a bit later. Really impressed with Burnley at Bournemouth. Really unimpressed with Asmir Begovic. What a nightmare. Honestly, he was a nervous wreck.
How did he get back in the team? I don't understand how he got back in the team, because Boric has done quite well.
Well, that's why I feel sorry for him, because my understanding is that both goalkeepers were told that Arta would be in for the rest of the season, and all of a sudden, Asmir, whose confidence clearly would have been dented by that, he's had a disagreement behind the scenes with Eddie Howe as well, is pitched back into the team, and you could see his confidence was just shot away on Saturday, and it caused the defence to make mistakes. And listen, if Bournemouth didn't get those points on the board pre-Christmas, they'd be in big trouble right now.
Interesting, isn't it? Because I watched a player who was dropped at the weekend and came off the bench and made a stunning impact and absolutely changed the nature of his club's history, possibly, with what he did in what was, I think, about a 40-minute cameo. It was unbelievable. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first of all, let's look back at the weekend in numbers.
The Geek Sheet. This week in numbers.
Liverpool came back from 1-0 down to earn their 82nd point of the season at Southampton. That total would have been enough to win the league in 1996, 97, 98, 99, 2001, 2011 and 2016. They still have 5 matches to play.
The current Premier League champions are now 12 wins away from an historic and unprecedented quadruple. They've won 22 of the last 23.
Heung-min Son scored the opening goal at the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in midweek, but it didn't stop the stadium running out of beer. That despite the pumps being able to pour 1,000 pints every minute and having a microbrewery in the southwest corner.
That's my biggest nightmare, running out of beer. Error-prone Asmir Begovic has now conceded 108 goals since the start of last season, the most of any Premier League keeper.
James Maddison has scored 3 direct free kick goals in the Premier League this season, the most by any player in a single campaign since Philip Coutinho in 2016-17.
Man City are the 9th different team to reach both major domestic English Cup finals in the same season, following Arsenal, Chelsea, Everton, Liverpool, Man United, Middlesbrough, Sheffield Wednesday and Spurs.
Gerard Deulofeu channeled his anger at being dropped to come off the bench and change the game with Wolves, becoming the 7th player in history to score a brace in an FA Cup semi-final.
We're going to talk about Coventry's plight later and hear from the Times' Henry Winter at length about his colourful life and career. But first, let's take you down into the inner sanctum of a football stadium where only the blessed few are permitted.
What a headshot!
It's time for Tales from the Tunnel.
What a weekend. The latest chapter in Manchester City's quest for a quadruple. I've started to believe it really could happen. I don't know about you, but I have started to believe that it could happen. Well, the reason I've started to believe it could happen is because one, Pep keeps saying, oh, why should we talk about this? He's playing it down in a sort of very Pep way, as if we're all stupid for the fact that we're even mentioning it. The fact is, if they win the next 12 games, they will be immortal. And it's the way they do it. They didn't really get out of second gear on Saturday night against Brighton. They made seven changes again. There was no Aguero. They've got injury issues, but they seem to just be going through the motions and getting the games won. And I look back at the 1999 wins towards the end of that season for Manchester United. No one really talks about the 0-0 draw with Blackburn or the 1-0 win away at Middlesbrough that helped get them over the line. Those are the sort of things that you have to do. You have to grind results out, and they've started to do
that. Do you want the big crookie shout for the week?
Go for it.
I said this to Adrian Durham, who I was with at Bournemouth on Saturday, and he thinks I'm absolutely bonkers. I think Spurs will knock them out of the Champions League over two legs.
Okay, well, that's okay, but no one's listening to your predictions after, on last week's podcast, you suggested Southampton would get something from Liverpool. But anyway, look, maybe that will happen. We'll soon find out this week because they play them on Tuesday night. Very much looking forward to that. I also got the privilege to go to the opening game at the Tottenham Stadium, which was magnificent. And if they do end up beating Manchester City, I'm sure that stadium and the atmosphere that is conjured in that huge bank behind one of the goals will make a huge difference to them. I think it was absolutely outstanding. I was also privileged to go to the Watford Wolves game. What a fantastic match. A tornado of twists and brilliant narratives. I mean, you've had the top level story where De La Feu, being furious about being dropped, reacting in the perfect way. Afterwards, Javi Gracia said he was happy about that. I liked it. I like players reacting in that way, he said. I bet, because he saved his bacon. They were 2-0 down, and Andre Gray, who he'd bought into the team, actually didn't do that much during the match. Troy Deeney's journey from jail to talismanic captain via overweight journeyman was complete with that nerveless penalty that he slotted in the 94th minute of the game to take it to extra time. I mean, that story is an absolute inspiration. I mean, we were talking about it yesterday on the programme, the fact that he had lost so much weight and got himself fit. It was at that point that Stuart Pearce said, what's more concerning is that he had 14 kilograms to lose.
It's a good shout, to be fair. And I thought his interview for TV afterwards was brilliant, spoke from the heart. He was demanding a new contract on BT, wasn't he? But I was slightly disappointed because I tweeted about that last night and said how refreshing it is to hear a footballer speaking like that in this day and age when most are over-media trained. And Simon Peach from the Press Association, who was at the game, pointed out he didn't walk through the mix zone afterwards to speak to the written media, which is slightly disappointing.
Yep. But I don't know how many interviews he had to do, but I can imagine it was quite a lot yesterday in that very congested broadcast area underneath Wembley Stadium. I thought it was a major mistake by Nuno Espirito Santo. Wasn't happy afterwards. He's been praised to the hilt, and correctly so, over the course of the season. But he took off Jota in the 89th minute and the game wasn't won. Mm. And Jota was the best player on the pitch. Jota gave them the out ball. Caballero came on, did nothing. Doesn't have the same quality as Diego Jota. They ended up losing the game because they had no other outlet. They thought they'd already won it and they hadn't done. So in all, look, it was a brilliant weekend. Plus, we got to see Tiger Roll, who quite frankly is the best horse I've ever seen live. I saw him at Cheltenham. I was blown away by him then. But he cruised the Grand National. Cruised the Grand National.
Yeah, he did. And it's a fantastic story. And you know, viewing figures for ITV Racing, 9.6 million watched that race. And I think he is a horse who is going to transcend his sport. He's a national treasure now. I hope he goes for a third next year. He's only nine. It wouldn't be beyond the realms of fantasy that he could win the Grand National. He's
Mike
only
O'Leary
6 to 1.
He's not going to put him in next year. But yeah, Gordon Elliott then said immediately afterwards, well, we'll see. We'll wait till March and make a decision. Michael can say what he likes, but actually, he'll probably change his mind three times in the next 6 months.
Yeah, when he hacks up in the cross country again. He's 6-1 anti-post to win the Grand National next year. Wow. I mean, I was reluctant. I put a fiver on for the wife at 5-1 to back him this year. I can't be backing him at sixes next year. But yeah, it was a great story. I saw it unfold while interviewing Eddie Howe. It's a nightmare that time, 5:15. Because we know if you're doing a 3 o'clock kickoff on a Saturday, that you're going to be doing your post-match when the Grand National is taking place. And obviously, as we're all sporting aficionados and sporting devotees, we all wanted to watch that race. My initial plan was to avoid it. I said to the wife, look, let's watch it when I get home about 8 o'clock at night, avoid the result. And then I walk out into the concourse under the stand, the Vitality, and it's on every big screen. Everybody in the press room's talking about it. I'd even asked Jonathan Overend from Five Live not to have his volume turned up in the tunnel, dialed into the programme so that we could try and avoid the result. But it was never going to happen. So in the end, I watched it on my phone. Eddie Howe came in to do his post-match media four fences from the last. So I thought, right, what am I going to do here? So I turned down the volume, held the phone in front of Eddie Howe as if I was recording his post-match interview while watching the Grand National and watching Tiger Roll romp home.
Oh, you ever the professional.
I still asked my questions and I still recorded the interview, but I did have one eye on the Grand National. So did Jonathan, by the way. He had his headphones on. He was listening to the race while interviewing Eddie Howe. It's just one of those unfortunate timings. But
It's obviously not a bad timing, is it? Because as you've already pointed out, nearly 10 million people watch it on ITV. And funnily enough, they don't schedule it so that you can do your post-match around the race. But it is great for the punters because they do get to follow their football throughout the course of the day. And then everybody gets drawn to the Grand National afterwards, and obviously the figures speak for themselves. And congratulations to everyone at ITV. I sent Ed Chamberlain a message this morning, and he came back saying he was absolutely delighted with those figures, and good luck to them because they've done a great job with that product, and it's a brilliant result. I had a great conversation actually with a couple of Manchester City fans in a Turkish restaurant on Saturday night. Mark Saggers was there. It was his idea to go to the Turkish restaurant. I was probably going to fancy the curry, but he pushed me into the Turkish place. It started off with us two having a conversation, and Saggers telling me, you know, he hit some brilliant stories, and actually he's going to come on the podcast between now and the end of the season, and he is one of the funniest men you'll ever meet. I mean, he's the most angriest man you'll ever meet, but he's also one of the funniest men you'll ever meet. And it started with a couple of these City fans heckling us about what they thought about TalkSport, and it was this and it was that, and this presenter says this, and you know, there was a bit of industrial language, and I thought, they've had a few beers, so I thought, do you know what, let's have a conversation. They were great. The lads were great, and it was so good to speak to them, because I think we got good feedback about what they feel about what the radio station is and should be, and we got some insight into, I think we got a point across actually as to what the radio station is, and how you can influence what comes out of the speaker by ringing the number or getting in touch with the various shows. I think fans feel everyone's biased against their club, and you know, this person will say this because they don't like us, blah 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 blah. And I said, let's start this conversation with this rule: no one hates your club, no one does. So take away that, have a conversation. What do you want to get on? They said, oh, we want it to be like honest opinions. I said, but that's what you have got. You've got people giving your honest opinions. The difference is you get offended by some of the honest opinions. Actually, some of the things they said I thought was valid, and you know, there's a few things in there I thought, well, yeah, I've done that occasionally, and I probably with unwittingly. But it did convince me that people do listen more carefully than maybe I thought, and also that the tribal nature of football means that no matter what happens, no group of fans, and rightly I suppose, is ever going to accept criticism of their club.
The best one I ever had on Twitter was when someone accused me of hating Manchester United. Yeah, okay.
As unbelievable. Their biggest fan. Well, yeah, the biggest fan, depending on what day it is and who's the manager and what the result was yesterday.
Listen, we're all fickle as football fans. Some fans will not permit you to say anything negative about their team at all. I don't understand that. As a fan, I think you're entitled to be hypercritical. And I don't understand people who just see everything through rose-tinted spectacles, because sometime, and I would say in the case
that's
of 80% of the clubs
fandom,
in the Football League.
And we'll get onto this with Henry a little bit later on. That's the nature of fandom. You can do that as a fan. And that's what I learned at the weekend. You know, fans are entitled to have that, not that I learned it at the weekend, but that's what was rammed home to me at the weekend. Fans can have that sort of myopic view where they just see one thing. They just see their club. They're all only interested in their club. That's all they have to be interested in. That is the role of us, the journalists, the newspaper men, the radio people, to give a balanced reasoned analysis of what's happening. Because as supporters are obviously leaning one way or the other. And Henry talks about that actually in the interview, which is coming up.
You are listening to the All Football Commentators Are Geeks podcast. Next, we'll be joined by Henry Winter, the chief football writer from The Times.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
The only people you know that can legitimately buy a pair of binoculars. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Henry Winter is the chief football writer at The Times, a role he coveted since he was 14 years of age. This weekend, Sam sat down for a lengthy chat with a man who never stops working and absolutely loves the game. Sam talks to him about his big move from The Telegraph and how journalism has changed since the mid-80s when Henry was making his way.
I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by Henry Winter from The Times. The first time I think we've had a written journalist on the podcast. But I suppose since you first started, the lines have sort of blurred a little bit between broadcast and written media, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's all about journalism. You're exactly the same. You see a story and you call it, whether it's out there, whether you're a television commentator or doing radio, but it's still journalism. It's as you see it. And it's the same with us. And yeah, I started in 86 at The Independent, straight out of university, managed to blag my way in there. And, you know, you go to games across the country. Well, I started out, actually, just sort of putting in telephones and things like that. And now this has absolutely changed everything because, you know, it's a personal hotspot. It's Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi's just changed our games completely. So, I mean, when I was starting out...
Why has Wi-Fi changed it?
Because when I was starting out, you would... occasionally not being able to, wherever you were, you wouldn't be able to get necessarily a phone line. So you walk out the stadium and knock on someone's door and say, excuse me, do you mind if I use your phone? Stick a couple of couplers on for this ancient Tandy machine where you had all your words sort of typed out, and it's very difficult to sort of cut and paste and move things around. And nice lady would be making you a cup of tea, and you say, oh, can I give you anything for the for the use of your telephone? Or you sort of rush out of the ground and see if you could find a phone box to use. So, I mean, it was chaos. Whereas now, we're sitting, and then, you've got your iPad there, we're streaming games on iPads, checking Twitter. Wi-Fi is just... it's like the invention of the car for journalists. I mean, it's just the ease. It's just completely changed life.
The internet itself, obviously, has exploded so many different mediums as well by, you've got social media, you've got bloggers, you've got vloggers, you've got podcasters, which is what we're doing here. Do you think that's a good thing for sports
Brilliant.
Coverage?
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic for sports coverage. I mean, all those sort of mediums you talk about, everyone is a journalist now. The rise of citizen journalists. If you've got a fan walking into the grounds and they see an incident, they can post that online, and within seconds that will go absolutely viral. So I think it's really good. But I think what it's also highlighted is the importance of journalism. I mean, trained journalists like you. If I look at the people who have got a big social media following on say Twitter in particular, because Twitter for me is the best journalistic medium. I don't do Facebook, I don't do the other stuff, just Twitter is just the immediacy of it and the range of it. If I look at say like a Danny Taylor at The Guardian, a Paul Joyce at Our Place Times, our Merseyside correspondent, Paul Haywood at the Telegraph, Sam Wallace at The Telegraph, people like that, because they're such good journalists and they've got such good judgment, they've got such experience, when they post something amidst the sort of, what Twitter's like, amidst the whole sort of Wild West brawl of Twitter, in a way that journalism, the quality of their journalism, shines through even more. So I think it's fantastic that everyone's able to be a journalist nowadays. But actually the fact that you have got, people of the quality of Danny and Sam and Paul, the two Pauls, and throughout, there's so many good journalists out there. A lot of guys, say Andy Naylor of the Brighton Argus, who would have been here yesterday covering the match. If I'm walking him to the ground down at Brighton, I will absolutely have 10 minutes going through all of Andy's recent tweets, because I know that I'm getting the gospel truth from a trained journalist about Brighton with no fear or favour, and it's absolutely brilliant. So I completely agree that it's been brilliant, that everyone, the whole world has turned into Speaker's Corner, and there's a lot of shouting and there's a lot of very good observation for fans. I mean, I probably follow about 800-900 fans of individual clubs for the sort of the insight and the views and the emotion about their club that they can give to me. But then also, I need an Andy Naylor to tell me everything, okay? Because Andy will speak to people at the top of the club, fans, players, everyone, to give me a true picture of what's going on at Brighton.
When I started this interview, I was tempted to introduce you as celebrity football journalist, but I know you're not comfortable with that. We've had this conversation before. But there was a lot of noise when you moved from one paper to the other. Why didn't you like it so much? Or do you feel like you had to do it?
Because I'm a journalist, I'm not the story. I'm incredibly lucky with this job. I'm going to probably interview sort of 60, 70 footballers and managers a season, sit down one-on-one with them, and we're here at Wembley today for the FA Cup semi-final. And I spent a long time with Will Hughes in the week, a player I've always talked about. So it's not about... I mean, I'm incredibly fortunate to go into these places and talk to these amazing individuals. I've never ever believed that footballers are boring. You know, I mean, early in my life, you know, people say, why do you want it? You know, I've got the job now, the individual job with the same title now that I wanted since I was 14. So people would always say, well, why football? Aren't they boring? You can only honestly, I think they're probably of the hundreds, maybe thousands of footballers I've interviewed, I only struggle once in an interview to get into an interview. I really struggle with Lauren at Arsenal, which is weird because he's had a really interesting life. And I went back and I analysed and said, why was it such a poor interview? And it was all my fault, I hadn't done enough research. So you go and you sit down with someone like Will Hughes and you get him to talk about his life. What are the influences that he had growing up from his parents, from school, from, you know, what players he admired growing up? He was a Michael Owen fan, a Steven Gerrard fan. What's it like being a footballer? And actually, we're in a very good place now with these young footballers because they want to talk, because they are empowered. I mean, we've seen it with Raheem Sterling. For me, one of the most important men in the country, let alone within football, because of the way he's called out the media, because of the way he's sort of called out the footballing authorities. I mean, I've interviewed Raheem on a couple of occasions, and he's absolutely fascinating. And what I do now, particularly with Raheem, I always take two tape recorders on, because I just know that everything he says is just going to be just fascinating. He actually talks like he plays, very effective, decisive, and I never want to take to break down.
You've obviously covered England quite a lot. You've written a book about England, and you mentioned Raheem Sterling there and his ability to communicate with the public, which is, I think, probably about time we've had the communication from the England players to the public via the media. It's changed immeasurably under Gareth Southgate. Why do you think he did that, and how much easier does it make your job?
I mean, it obviously makes my job easier, and it makes my job more fun, because I'm going to sit down with a footballer and have a proper chat with him about football without him being a little bit wary. The great thing that Southgate's done, and he's done it for a very footballing reason, he said he obviously wants the players to express themselves on the pitch, and there's always been an inhibition about the players. I mean, you've covered England, you know what the players were like. There was always that little bit of paranoia, and the shirt weighed heavily. And I mean, there was one player who told me when I was doing that book ages ago, I said, God, it must be so exciting standing in the tunnel playing for England. It's a serious England international, serious goal scorer. And I said, what are you thinking about just before you walk out? You're thinking about the sort of the pride your family and your friends must feel. You're talking about how's it going to go against the individual centre half you're up against. And he said, no, all I can think about is the ratings I'm going to get in the papers in the morning. Because if it's bad, you know, if it's like a 4 out of 10, then his mother's going to have it mentioned when she goes into the, goes sort of out shopping or goes into work or whatever, and it affects all their families. And I can remember when Rob Green in 2010 made the mistake against America. Against America, it didn't just affect him. It affected his family. And I think, from what I remember, his ex-girlfriend had a photographer in her back garden. So this whole sort of ripple effect, particularly with England, the tiniest thing is hugely important with England. That's why it's more important than club football. That's why it still commands huge, you know, when you do a commentary, it commands sort of huge figures. When we write about it, you know, every newspaper has a spike in sales. Like last, the World Cup was fantastic for everyone in the media. So what Southgate did is he just took the heat out of the situation and he said, right, I want the players to express themselves on the pitch, and I want them to express themselves off the pitch via the media. He went out to the Super Bowl, saw how the Super Bowl media day worked. Now, fair play to the FA and Andy Walker, because he sort of expedited it. He got the players to buy in, and all 23 of them turned up to this. They had all, you were there, they had all the sort of the podiums at St George's Park, and it was brilliant. And they also, and Danny Rose spoke very emotionally about mental health. Raheem Sterling spoke to everyone for an hour and then stayed on for about 10-15 minutes afterwards, just chatting off the record to us wastes and strays who were still around. And that was pretty much the morning of all the sort of the gum to two thing and all the, you know, the criticism that he got on that. So I just think it built the relationship. I mean, remember, it was only, what, 2 years ago that England fans were walking off at half time in Malta, picking up their flags. Movement of flags is always a key indicator on the emotional connection between the fans with England. And they just, and Gareth Southgate has rebuilt that connection.
And obviously it can't influence what happens on the pitch in terms of nothing that we say ever matters really in terms of how they perform. But that freedom to express themselves, that breaking down of the barrier between the press and the players, do you think it gives them a little bit more of a license to go and do their own job without fear of failure?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's exactly what Gareth Southgate came from, because he went through a period with some incredibly talented England players when he played here in the old stadium, but they never produced their club form because of this inhibition, because of the weight of the shirt. And I think they've absolutely gone out and expressed themselves, and it's fantastic, and it's you know, it's built up that relationship with the media. And I spoke to Fabian Delph at the end of it, and I said, listen, this has been an absolutely magical 5 weeks. It's been so much easier for the English press, just because the story's really good. I mean, classic case, Harry Maguire was doing one interview. Harry Maguire's one of the most really interesting individuals you can meet. I went and spent some time with him and his siblings before the World Cup. You would not have had that before another tournament, so fair play for him for doing that. But anyway, during the World Cup, you were probably there when we were out in Repino, England's base. He was sitting there, and it was a really good interview. I mean, there were sort of like 20 journalists around, and then Jamie Vardy appeared at the back, started throwing in questions. So, Slabhead, how big is your head? And it was just brilliant. And it just, that would not have happened under previous regime. So great credit to Southgate, to Andy Walker, and also the players. And I think what we've got now, and we've seen it in recent weeks, because you've been covering it, is that the players are very empowered, and they are taking the lead on serious issues, particularly racism. I mean, like, when Raheem posted that Instagram message the day after the Chelsea game, when he got abused there, I rang the office immediately and said, listen, I need to write on this. We need to lead on this, because that Instagram post is one of the most important things that's happened in football. I've been doing this, 35 years, I don't really get that carried away. But I said, it's such a key moment for football and the media, and for society as well, and its relationship with sort of diversity. And that's why players are so powerful now. And I love seeing and hearing Raheem standing up like that, and the other players, Danny Rose, standing up on a range of issues. And they are incredibly powerful now. And they are changing society, these young players. And look, I came into journalism because I love watching Malcolm McDonald growing up, sort of, you know, in the early 70s. And I love the football. And for me, it's about the 90 minutes. But actually, you are seeing young footballers changing society.
More from Henry later on paywalls, on his brother's double first from Cambridge as well.
It's all over, I think.
No. Subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts and all major podcast platforms. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Well, last week I sent a tweet out in the middle of Wednesday about the stories surrounding Coventry City and Bolton Wanderers and how heartbreaking it was. This weekend, Crook went up to Coventry to cover their 0-0 draw with Bristol Rovers. And whilst he was up there, we had him investigate as to why exactly Coventry could end up being homeless.
Cheers, Sam. I've just walked past the statue of the late, great Jimmy Hill on my way into the Ricoh Arena for what will be my first and maybe last commentary here, because, of course, come the end of the season, Coventry could be homeless, could be playing elsewhere, could be booted out of the Football League. Let's go inside and see what the local journalists are saying. Okay, I'm in the press box now at the Recon with Andy Turner from the Coventry Telegraph. Andy, first of all, how long have you been covering the fortunes of the Sky Blues?
My first game, in fact, was back in the glory days of the Premier League, and my first match was Liverpool away in the third round of the FA Cup, which the Sky Blues won 3-1, having just beaten Manchester United 3-2 at home. The game before I took over. So fantastic time to sort of start covering the club, but sadly it's all been downhill virtually ever since. This is a story that's gone to judicial reviews, to the high courts, and you know, it's become more, it's more than a football story. You know, that is dealt with on a day-to-day basis by the news people, and I just haven't got time to do that. I dip in now and again, but for the most part I try and focus on the football.
Coventry are not an isolated example of clubs who are struggling for one reason or another off the pitch. We've seen Oxford unable to pay their staff in recent weeks. The Bolton situation has been well documented. The chief sports reporter at the Bolton newspaper was actually banned by the club because of stuff that was being written. Have you ever found yourself in that situation when your paper have criticised Sisu or the owners and that's had ramifications for you?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, in January of this year, I ended a two-year ban, and that was brought about by the newspaper's editorial stance against the owners, a campaign that the Coventry Telegraph and Coventry Live ran. And so, yeah, so I spent 2 years where I wasn't allowed at writing at the training ground, to pretty much press conferences, I mean, at post-match interviews, but just able to record or take notes, and that was it, not asking any questions, which was quite frustrating, particularly when we got to the Checkatrade Trophy final, and you know, the biggest event that I'd covered in all my 20 years. And there I was, not allowed to go to the pre-match press conference ahead of the Wembley trip.
OK, I'm back up in the press box now with Clive Eakins from BBC Coventry and Warwickshire. Give us an update. What is the main issue between Coventry City Football Club and Wasps, who own the stadium now?
I mean, it's a relatively straightforward impasse, which is that Wasps said when they agreed a one-year deal last season, they said at the time that they wouldn't have any further discussions as long as the football club's owners were pursuing legal action, which is against the council, but obviously affects Wasps. It affects Wasps' future here. And the club's owners aren't prepared to stop the legal action. So that's where the impasse is. And unless one side or other gives way, then it's hard to see where they go next.
And obviously you would have been covering the club when they played their home games at Northampton. It was a disaster, really. Fans boycotting matches. Do you see a similar scenario unfolding this time around?
Well, I'd be interested to see. I mean, I've been asking the question to fans whether they will go this time, and I'm getting differing answers. There'll certainly be a lot that won't go if they're sharing outside Coventry. There might be some who will go this time who didn't last time, but it still won't be great. And it was pretty miserable at Northampton. And it was the club's managing director at the time, Steve Waggett, who said to the club's owners, this isn't working, we have to get back to the Ricoh Arena. So now they say they want to be at the Ricoh Arena, but they can't get over this particular stumbling block.
So if that was my last ever commentary at the Ricoh, not one to remember. 0-0 draw in the end. I'm off to the touchline now to speak to Mark Robbins. In a big couple of weeks off the pitch as well. Do you know of any update in terms of your search for a home for next season?
No. I've no clue. And in all honesty, it's that's nothing to do with me. I can't affect it. Players can't affect it. We just have to get on and try and learn to score goals. We're almost a really, really good team, a top team in the division, and that's brilliant. You know, at this stage of our development, we only got promoted in the summer, and we're a different case to the other teams that were promoted anyway. Given a fair wind and keep moving in the same direction, in the right direction, and if we can get the resolution to the issues around the stadium, I think we've got a great chance next season.
Just in the car now. Oh, let's turn Matt face off. Just in the car now on my way home. Let's hope Coventry have a home to call their own next season, that common sense prevails. But it's worrying times for them, worrying times for a number of football league clubs. And I do think it's about time the authorities did something to stop repeats of this happening in the future.
Andy Turner saying that he was banned for 2 years just because he took a stand against the owners is indicative of everything that is wrong about owners and the way they deal with the local media, in fact, any media. I don't think banning the media ever does you any favours, and actually is the first sign that things are about to go south. Because if you don't want to be scrutinised, then there's obviously something that's going on that you don't want people to know.
Yeah, you're dead right, and we've seen it happen up and down the country. I know the guys who cover Bolton have had issues with the owner where they've not been allowed to attend games. Derek Adams at Plymouth has just banned the Plymouth Herald because he wasn't happy with what he perceived as a negative match report after a disappointing draw at home. I've had it myself. I was banned from Portsmouth three times in one season as they were going through their financial problems. One of the bans was because I had the audacity to bring up Nico Kranjčkar's former club and ask if he was on loan rather than actually have been signed permanently as Pompey had purveyed. So, as you say, you know when a club starts doing that, they've got plenty to hide. And it never ends well. Because invariably it just makes the journalist dig deeper. It certainly did in my case.
Okay, let's get back to our interview with Henry Winter of The Times. He was with Sam at Wembley this weekend.
You notoriously go to a lot of games.
You can talk. You go to more than me.
No way. The joke is you go to a game every day. Is that true?
No, you can't. Yeah, it's a slightly sensitive. I mean, my son is occasionally known as Rob Lee in the household. He was born the night before Rob Lee made his debut here against Mexico in 97. And I did leave the hospital. I got a fantastic rollicking from the midwife, quite rightly. Drove back down to London. I did the press conference the day before, went up, son was born, came back down. But it was, yeah, I always know Toby. I always remember Toby's, my son's birthday, because it was when Rob Lee made his debut. It's incredible. We're incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been all over the world. I mean, I've done, what, 8 World Cups, however many European Championships, loads of Champions League, FA Cup finals. And every day is a privilege in this job. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to do this job is that Geoffrey Green was the famous football writer in the 60s and 70s at the Times. And he always had a Christmas tree at home. Had a small cottage in Twickenham. Every day of the year, he had a Christmas tree up, angel on top, fairy lights burning, even when it was like sort of 90 degrees outside in the middle of July. And he was famous. I said, why have you got this? And he said, because when you're a football journalist, every day is Christmas Day. And we are incredibly privileged. And our generation is even more privileged than the previous generations because of the amazing football we've got to cover, because, you know, the Wi-Fi, because of the incredible stadium, and also because the unbelievable appetite for football in this country. I mean, I've just walked, I parked my car in the usual place, just walked through here, and there can't be anyone left in Wolverhampton. It is crazy how obsessed, I mean, it's brilliant how obsessed we are with football, how important the pyramid is, the 92. I mean, I live near Stamford, and they're what, I think about 8th or 9th tier of football. You go there, there's a good crowd, there's good football, nice stadium, and you just think, for me, from a very selfish perspective, how lucky am I just to have this incredible national obsession to write about?
Well, I was here for the Portsmouth game, literally a week and a bit ago. And there was 85,000 people here, and that just shows you just how important a third-tier game can be between two sides.
Between
amazing.
Two great clubs, I mean, historic clubs, you know, you think about sort of what they've achieved in history, but you also think two powerful sets of support who kept their clubs going through the bad times. So it's fantastic that day out for them. I mean, it's a dramatic ending. But what also made it for me, I mean, they might have lost in London on the Sunday, but they certainly won in Trafalgar Square on the Saturday night. The Sunderland fans there, the pictures that Sunderland fans were posting, I mean, even Nelson must have looked down and smiled.
We've talked about the future of the current state with the social media and the way that football is covered. I just wondered, going forward, what you thought football is going to look like and how we are going to cover it in the future, because I feel at the moment we're in an odd situation where we're sort of at the cusp of a real serious digital revolution, but we haven't found the destination of how we're going to do it just yet.
I think it's very exciting because I look at it from my perspective as, like, inverted commas, old school journalist. Newspapers haven't quite died yet. I mean, our circulation, you know, the Times, we're still making money. The app is doing a great thing. So I think the old school football journalism is going to continue, but just in similar formats, but also new formats as well. I mean, iPads are just, I mean, the coverage on the iPad, I'll never see you far away from the iPad, and it is the quality on there, the quality of the photographs there. I think we'll see an increase in the depth of the quality of football photography in this country. I mean, everyone talks about football journalists, and it's, you know, that's nice. The quality of the photography in this country. I mean, I occasionally do paper reviews, and I say, can I just do it on the photographs? And they say, well, that doesn't really work on radio. And I get that. But the photography, because of the, you know, the quality and cameras and digital, and it's, you know, they can be behind the goal there, and they can, through the power of Wi-Fi, they can put an amazing picture around the world within sort of 3-4 seconds. Now, obviously, the world that you work in with the moving image, it's very powerful. But some of these pictures that these photographers get, they are works of art. And you've got a very interesting blend at the moment, because you've got a fair few photographers who've been around a long time, who understand the game, who understand how a move's going to develop, who understands how, say, Raheem Sterling is going to make a certain run, and they will be ready for the money shot, for that key moment when they get that photograph. So I think when we talk about sort of the future of football journalism, photography is just going to be off the scale in terms of the quality. For us, it will be more social media. I mean, Ollie Kay, who I work with, who's a brilliant journalist, he does a lot on Facebook, and his articles are really interesting. And you know what? There's some things that I might not be able to get into the paper at the time. So I write a lot on community initiatives that clubs do. Portsmouth. Claire Martin at Portsmouth is just absolutely unbelievable. I mean, she was just almost the sort of beacon for that club when it went through the really dark days. And, you know, say, I mean, I love stories like this, and it just shows how powerful football is. But Claire would ring up, if Illustrious or Ark Royal, one of the great aircraft carriers, would come into the dock at Portsmouth. She would ring up the captain, get through to the captain and say, listen, we've got loads of kids around here in Portsmouth who, because, as you know, it's all built up, there's very little pitches for these kids to play on. Can you clear some of the sort of the jump jets, Harriers off your poop deck, so that we can actually go and play some football up there? And they do that, and that is the power of football. Claire's obviously brilliant like that. So a little story like that, to be honest, I actually did get that in the Times, because the Times thought it was a great story. But but little things that you can put out on social media, like community initiatives. Everton's community schemes are fantastic. Arsenal, you know, they save lives, let alone changing lives. And so some of the stuff, you know, clubs will send me stuff, and so it'd be brilliant if you could get this in the Times, because of maybe pressure on space, newsworthiness and all that, not always going to get it in. But you can tweet about sort of Everton sending Duncan Ferguson along to a local club, where the sort of the coach there has been just, you know, he's just great, great individual, whatever. So, so yeah, social media, I mean, I get a lot of emails from clubs asking me to post stuff about their initiatives, and really important, and things like, you know, the Offside Trust, and the sort of, you know, the battle against sort of effectively paedophiles in sport. You know, I mean, Danny Taylor does brilliant work on that in the Guardian. But you can retweet things like, you know, they had a match last weekend against Hollyoaks 11 fundraiser. So again, for social media, you can put that out, and I think that will become more and more in the future. And I think what has been really interesting, I've noticed it in the last sort of 6 to 9 months. Clubs have always been a little bit wary about relationships with journalists, and a lot of them just want content for their own website. I think the intelligent ones, like Everton, are loosening up a bit. Arsenal is still not very good, but Manchester United are becoming better. This City are good. Liverpool are very good at it. And actually working more with journalists to say, listen, we've got a really good announcement. Let's sort of work with you, and sort of you put it out on social media and stuff like that. It's not going to be earth-shattering stuff about new contracts for players. Actually, occasionally they will do that, new contracts for players, because they want the message to get out as broadly as possible. So social media for what? I would not have got the job at the Times without Twitter.
Why is that? Because you had so many followers?
Yeah, paywall. Because I think the Times thought that, because I got a lot of followers, that some of them would come through the paywall. Now, to be honest, I don't have a problem with paywall, because if you're going, you know, you have to pay for content. I don't like the Guardian model, and I'll never work for the Guardian, because I don't like their business model. I just don't think it's. I think it's slightly demeaning to their own journalists, because the Guardian got some fabulous journalists. Barney Roney's one of the best writers on any subject. Marina Hyde, Danny Taylor. I mean, there's a golden age of writing about that. Removing from the you know, the sort of football correspondent or chief football writer side, the actual quality of individual columnists out there, Jonathan Liu, people like that at the Eye and the Indy, the quality out there is really good. But I don't have a problem that people should actually pay for it.
You know. It's my grandstand ringtone
it's
going.
It's fantastic.
On.
I tell you what, that is. That's brought back some memories.
Yeah. I was gonna talk to you about newspapers coming to life, but I think we covered that with the app. The app, the idea of things happening as you're reading it. I love that idea. But just some quick fire questions before I let you go. You're not the only intelligent man in your family. Your brother has got a double first from Cambridge. Who used to win the games of Trivial Pursuit between the two of you?
He is, well, even more important than his academic record, he was voted amongst the 40 most influential Muslims in the world. Mm. So we've had some very interesting debates about the Quran, about religion. I mean, I was a choir boy at school in Westminster Abbey. So we sort of took slightly sort of divergent paths. I would never, ever go up against my brother in a quiz. I wouldn't. He would even get my name quicker than I would when we were filling it in. He is supremely bright, very impressive. And it's really nice. You go into a lot of grounds and, you know, say like Arsenal, you've got a lot of Muslim supporters, and you'll be walking there and they said, and they'll be shouting and they said, "You're so abusive about Arsene Wenger. Why were you so hard on him? By the way, your brother's an absolute genius."
Out of all of your books that you've written, what is your favourite? And you've written biographies of Dalglish, Barnes, Gerrard.
I really enjoyed doing Stephen Gerrard because of his complete honesty and respect to Liverpool, because when you do books like that, they have to be run past the club, and Liverpool, Rick Parry, and the club generally were actually very good, because there was some stuff that was critical of the club in there and they didn't change anything. So Stephen Gerrard's honesty, it was also great fun doing, and for me, it was sort of someone from quite a nice family in the sort of the centre of London, to actually go up to Highton and sit in a housing estate and just have my eyes opened so that I could understand sort of how Stephen Gerrard sort of evolved. That was fascinating. I really enjoyed doing the Carrick book because I find Michael Carrick such an interesting character. And again, you don't do it for money, you do it because you learn. I learned so much from Michael Carrick. He's a very calm, composed individual, how he deals with the pressure on him as a footballer, and also out and about, you know, if he goes out with his kids to the Trafford Centre, you know, it can be difficult, and how he keeps calm like that. I enjoyed Dalglish. I found the Dalglish book very emotional to do, particularly when he started talking about Hillsborough, because he found it very difficult to talk about Hillsborough, and then he eventually did. And it was just, it was incredibly powerful. He just talked for probably about 35 minutes, and I just ran that verbatim in the book, because there was nothing to change, because it was just so powerful, and it was from the heart, as it always is with Kenny Dalglish. So I was just, you know, I remember walking out of his house in Southport that night, getting back in the car to drive south, and thinking, God, how privileged I am to be, you know, they call journalism, you know, the first draft of history, and to be with Dalglish there and to hear that, I'm going, this is just so powerful. And then you have this strange time lag with books that it doesn't come out for another 9 months. Yeah. So people say, oh, how's the book with Kenny going? I'm going, it's really interesting, and you can't say anything more, and then it comes out and it does well. So, you know, all books like that. I did the book on England myself, because I wanted to analyse better why England had struggled, and also the Telegraph in a strop put me on gardening leave, and I haven't got a very big garden, so I thought I might as well go and write a book.
Listen, thanks for giving us the time. We really appreciate it. Yeah. And good luck, and we'll speak to you soon.
Brilliant.
Cheers.
That's all we've got time for this week. Hope you enjoyed listening. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram on @AFCGeeks. Join us again next week.
Shots on a Friday.
Back in the net.
Yeah, this lot think I'm talking about the championship match. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Open the door to huge savings now at Menards. Enhance the appearance of your home with a new stylish garage door. Choose from our large in-stock selection of ideal garage doors, or design your own using our free garage door designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big and ideal garage doors. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save